I have a question for you. Okay? I have a question for you. You don't have to answer it out loud, but it's a question that I want you to think about. And it's simply this. Is life intuitive? Is life intuitive? Okay? In 2006, 2007, Microsoft wanted to redesign their word processor. Most software companies refresh the software so that you'll buy the next package, but they wanted to have an overall redesign of the thing. And one of the things that really pushed them to this is that they were constantly getting requests to put features into their word processor that were already there. All right, people were saying, can you make it do this? And the answer was, well, it does. And what about this feature? And they said, well, that's already in. And the fact of the matter was that there was all these things in this package and people didn't know they were there. So the idea was they redesigned it to make it more obvious, quite simply because people don't read the instructions, do they? If you get a phone, one of the new smartphones or something like that, there's a lot of argument depending on whose particular kind of application you like. But the thing is that these are supposedly intuitive. You don't need instructions, you just use them and you can follow through and you'll find everything there is to find in there. You might have noticed that if you buy an item, an electronic item, more often than not, sometimes it will come with instructions. And certainly going back a year or two, it used to be the case where you get a big thick book of instructions and then you get a little pamphlet with a couple of pages. The big thick book was the instructions and the few pages were the quick start guide for people who didn't want to be bothered to read the instructions, yeah? They wanted it to be intuitive. People don't want to waste time sort of reading the instructions. They want to use it. Just give it to me and I'll use it. And what's the famous phrase? If all else fails, read the instructions. Because you should certainly, obviously, be able to just work your way through it. I must admit, I'm not too convinced about the idea of intuitive systems. Either that or perhaps I don't think the same way as the people who've designed them do. And it's also interesting when you get people who are following one particular way of doing things and you put them in a different situation and suddenly, well, that isn't there and I can't find this and what have you. And how often do you hear the sort of comment, oh, I don't know how to do that, or I didn't know it did that, or oh, could you show me how it does this? You see, at the extremes, you will get people who are the ultimate pressers and guessers. They'll try everything. They'll press everything, just try it, see what happens. And at the other end, you get the complete geeks who will take the manual. Well, they won't take the manual. They'll have to download the manual. And they will read it from cover to cover. And basically, everybody else is somewhere in between. Do you sit and read it? Or do you just want to use it? Supposedly these things are intuitive, but is life intuitive? I want to read you a quote. It's from a guy called Brian Harding. He's written a book, he's got a blog and everything else, such things like that. The book is actually called Sneezing Jesus. Alright, that seems an unusual title, but what he's saying is this: that if we are really 100% for God, then everything we do, there'll be Jesus in it. We'll be following his path, we'll be doing it his way, so that even if you sneeze, Jesus comes out. You get the idea. This is the quote. If you listen to the words of Jesus given in the Gospels, you become aware that he's describing a kingdom and a worldview that's different from the systems and cultures that we are living in. So different, in fact, that it's almost the opposite way around to the way that we live. It's almost completely opposite to the way that we'd normally react. It's inside out and backwards. It not only tells us so much about God's kingdom, it also gives us a clear contrast with what we've made of things here on earth. Brian Harding there is describing a kingdom, he's describing God's kingdom, he's describing a structure, he's describing a layout, he's describing something other. The way things are done, the way things are. Different ways of living. So different to be almost the complete opposite. When we went to India, there were many things that were surprising, different, interesting. One of the things that we came across so often when we're praying for people, the women would be saying, "Pray for a husband." The men would be saying, "Pray for a wife." And Diane made the comment one time while coming back in the minibus. She says, "Do you know, Frederick, you seem to have an awful lot of single women and an awful lot of single men. Why don't you do the obvious thing and just bring them together?" And his reply is, "You can't do that. You've got to take into account their social status. You've got to take into account their upbringing. You've got to take into account the expectations. Why, you've even got to take into account their height." And you're thinking, what? It's so different. And in some ways, the culture that we have and the culture that God would like is so opposite, so different. We sort of look and think, what? It causes surprise, it causes shock, it causes misunderstanding. And what Brian Hardin's saying there in the quote is that that's the way it is with us. It's opposite to what we might expect. It's not intuitive. It's not normal. It can't be guessed. In some ways, it's what they might call counterintuitive. And that causes problems. Another guy called Samuel D. James has written this. Have a listen to this quote. He says, "There is no safe corner of the Christian story that is completely intuitive or unfailingly neighbourly. Every element of the gospel can and will grate against our modern sense of real life. That there will be a collision between real life and revelation is guaranteed. What we need to figure out is how much of real life we will look at through the lens of truth and how much we won't." What he's saying is that if you take the gospel, people will like some bits of it. What seems to fit in with their expectations, what they think is normal, what they like. You know, you will find many times people will say, "Oh yeah, it's brilliant, God is love." Unfortunately, that's tied in with other things as well, because God is righteous, God is just, God is faithful. But then we don't really want those other bits tagged onto the bit of God is love. We just like the bit that God is love. The full story causes issues and causes problems. Samuel James talks there about the gospel grating. The car that we had before last, I was getting it out of the backyard one day. I don't know whether you know where we live, but it's a fairly short drive. And opposite, there's a sort of a lat fence. Now, if you got the car in the right place in the drive and you take the right swing at it and you get the doors open to the right angle, you can get out in one swing. However, if you're not quite... Well, I was going to say, all right, well, that's pretty straightforward. If you're lazy and you don't open the gates fully, then you've cut down the arc that you can take. Well, one day I was getting out and I was in a bit of a rush and I didn't open the gates quite as much as I should, and out I went. And as I'm getting closer, I'm thinking, no, I can make this, I can get round. Famous man sort of idea, yeah, we can do it. And then I hit the fence. I didn't hit it hard, but I saw the wood move. I thought, oh, no, I've overdone this, I'll come back. But the problem was that the car had sort of got wedged in the fence. And as I pulled back, it started pulling the wood off the fence. I thought, what am I going to do here? I suppose I ought to get out and sort it. No, I'm in a rush, I'll carry on. So then I carried on. And as I went onto the next piece of the wood and it sort of moved. And then on the next bit. And then you hear that sort of slightly sickening sound, don't you, as things sort of rubbing against it. It was grating. And it took the corner off the front corner of the paint off the front corner of the car. It grated. It ground. All right? And what Samuel James is saying is that in real life, you will find that the gospel grates. you will find there's that abrasion, you will find there's that difference that causes an issue. The difference between what we call normal life and what we'd call the way God wants life to be lived. All modern cars are put through tests. They're put through a crash test, basically to make sure that they're safe. They've got all sorts of things designed in. Obviously, you've got your airbags and everything else, but you have things called crumple zones that take the damage as it sort of thumps into it. They sort of deform and deflect to take the energy and to preserve the people inside. Now, I've got to put a rider on what's going to happen next. If you love Lego, you might find this next bit distressing. Okay, that's just a warning. Lego make all sorts of wonderful things. Lego Technic make incredible things, working things. Lego Technic make cars. And somebody, a sad person, built up one of these expensive Lego Technic kits of a Porsche and then put it through a crash test. Stephen, could you run the video for us, please, the PowerPoint? Here's the slow motion bit. Multiple views of the same event, gradually getting closer to the wall. You will. Not an awful lot left of that, is there? It's not pretty. It's not nice. Certainly wouldn't want to ride in one of those. Not much left either. What Samuel James is saying is that when normal life meets the real gospel, you get a crash. It's not pretty. It's not nice. It's not easy. And that will happen to us. Before we know God, we're steeped in the world. We grow up in Him, and we find there are differences. And first of all, there's a crash in our heart, because suddenly things don't happen, work out, work the way that we're used to, or even want them to. And it hurts. We can protest. That's not right. That's not fair. God, you can't expect me to. We can reason. Ah, well, you can see from the context it doesn't actually mean that. We can ignore. Carry on as we are. There's still going to be a crash, but we've actually got our eyes closed. The sad fact of the matter is that reality is very cruel with dreams. I've read you two quotes. But are they true? Let's have a look and see. John chapter 13, verses 10 and then 18 through to 30. This is what it says. It's coming up to the time when he'll be betrayed. It's the Last Supper. He's gone round and he's washed their feet. Then he's talking to them afterwards. Those who have had a bath need only to wash their feet. Their whole body is clean. And you are clean, though not every one of you, for he knew who was going to betray him, and that was why he said, not everyone is clean. Jesus said, I'm not referring to all of you. I know those who I have chosen, but this is to fulfill the passage of Scripture. He who shared my bread has turned against me. I'm telling you now before it happens, so that when it does happen, you will believe that I am who I am. Very truly I tell you, whoever accepts anyone I send accepts me. Whoever accepts me accepts the one who has sent me. After he said this, Jesus was troubled in spirit, testified, very truly I tell you, one of you is going to betray me. His disciples stared at him, one and another, at a loss as to know which of them he meant. One of them, the disciple whom Jesus loved, was reclining next to him. Simon Peter motioned to this disciple and said to him, ask him which one he means. Leaning back against Jesus, he said to him, "Lord, who is it?" Jesus answered, "It is the one to whom I will give this piece of bread when I have dipped it in the dish." Then, dipping the piece of bread, he gave it to Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot, and as soon as Judas took the bread, Satan entered into him. So Jesus told him, "What you are about to do, do quickly." But no one at the meal understood why Jesus had said that to him. Since Judas had charge of the money, some thought Jesus was telling him to buy what was needed for the festival or to give something to the poor. As soon as Judas had taken the bread, he went out, and it was night. We got there the story of the fact that Jesus knew who was going to betray him. Just sort of use your imaginations a little while. You're in a room. You know that somebody's about to betray you. There's 12 of you, and there's one of him. What odds has he got? Not very good odds, has he? I mean, I suppose you could sort of turn on him and beat him up, but you could just sort of grab him, tie him up. Yeah? There's 12 of you. Or even once he's gone, you could say, well, he thinks I'm going to the Garden of Gethsemane, but instead I'll go to somewhere else. But he didn't. He let him do it. But that's not right. That's not fair. That's not just. We have systems in place, and when they're not counter to God's ways, we need to follow them. Many rules and laws are based on God's word. Those change, those develop, and sometimes move away from. We have a legal system. It's definitely far from perfect. And there are systems in place that help to make things fair and regulate them. Systems of government. And where we can use those systems, we do. But there are times when we will exhaust the system and there is no justice. There are times when we will be faced with wrong and we are unable to correct. There are times when we will look full in the eyes of someone who perhaps is going to betray us, who's hurt us, who's done us wrong. They will know and we will know. But there's nothing else that can be done about it. There are times when we will be betrayed. There are times when evil will have the top hand, so it seems. And this is one of those times. Jesus knew who was going to betray him. He knew exactly what was going to happen, and he still let it happen. Surely if God was telling him what was going to happen, this was a chance for him to step in and do something about it. It's a warning. Let's use it. Let's stop it. But that's the crash. Because that's not what God wanted to do. In 1 Peter 2:23 it says this, "When they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly." He was prepared to trust God to work it out. He left it in God's hands. It's not fatalistic where people say, it must have meant to be. What will happen will happen. With fatalism, there is no choice. With here, there is full choice. We choose to follow God's way, despite the crash. In Luke 4:22-30, he went to his hometown of Nazareth and basically spoke the words of Isaiah on the scroll to them. And it says this, "All spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his lips. 'Isn't this Joseph's son?' they asked. Jesus said to them, 'Surely you will quote this proverb to me, physician, heal yourself. You will tell me, do here in your hometown what we have heard you did in Capernaum.' 'Truly I tell you,' he continued, 'no prophet is accepted in his own hometown. I assure you that there were many widows in Israel in Elijah's time when the sky was shut for 3.5 years and there was a severe famine throughout the land. Yet Elijah was not sent to any of them, but to a widow in Zarephath in the region of Sidon. And there were many in Israel with leprosy in the time of Elisha the prophet, yet not one of them was cleansed, only Naaman the Syrian. All the people in the synagogue were furious when they heard this. They got up, drove him out of the town, took him to the brow of the hill on which the town was built in order to throw him off the cliff. At this point, Jesus could have protested. He could have done all sorts of things. You know, he's just starting his ministry. Surely this is not the way it's meant to be. They're going to throw him off the cliff. They're going to kill him. They've had enough. He's given them the truth. They don't like it, so he's going to suffer. And he doesn't fight against it. He doesn't fight against it. The next verse says this: but he walked right through the crowd and went on his way. Exactly what happened there, I haven't got a clue. It doesn't tell us. But what they were going to do, what they were on the point of doing, did not happen. God somehow worked it out. Jesus trusted the one who judges fairly and put himself, his life, his ministry, the whole thing in God's hands and said, well, you sort it out. And he did. God intervened at the last moment. How close they got to the cliff edge, I do not know. But I think if I'd have been there, I'd have been fighting an awful long time before we got to the edge of the cliff. Probably wouldn't have done any good, but you understand the point. Jesus didn't. Again, it's not fatalistic. He made the choice to do what God wanted. Even later in John's Gospel 18, when they're actually in the garden, it says Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place where Jesus had often met there with his disciples. So he came to the garden, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officials from the chief priests and the Pharisees. They were carrying torches, lanterns, weapons. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen, interesting, he's still there, he knows what's going to happen, but he's still going through with it, went out and asked them, who is it that you want? Jesus of Nazareth, they replied. I am he, Jesus said. Judas the traitor was standing there with them. When Jesus said, I am he, they drew back and fell to the ground. At which point, Jesus turned round to the disciples and said, okay, we've got his chance, run! No, he didn't, did he? That would have been the perfect place to do it, wouldn't it? Who do you want? Jesus of Nazareth. I am he. Down they go. Right, we're off. Leg it. But he didn't. He was prepared to take the crash. It says a little bit later, it says, then Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant's ear, cutting it off. Jesus commanded Peter, put away your sword, shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me? I mean, there was only one of them fighting back, so it wouldn't have lasted long. But Jesus said, whoa, that's not the way. Jesus faced the crash of what was considered normal and what God wanted, and he faced the impact. He suffered the impact. It was unfair. It was unjust. It was wrong. But he was prepared to let God work it out. It's not fatalistic. It's not a case of whatever he did, it was going to happen. It was a case of this was the path, and he chose to follow the path. The last piece of Samuel James's quote said this: what we must figure out is how much of real life we will look at through the lens of truth and how much we will not. How much are we prepared to say, God, this is unfair, this is unjust, this is wrong, they're conspiring against me. The indignation can rise, but God, this is the path that you've set me on, and I will willingly follow it. Life lived like that will grate. Life lived like that will result in a crash. As we look at the results of the impact on that Lego car, it's virtually smashed to pieces. And if you live life like that, at times your heart will be smashed to pieces. Is life intuitive? Life lived God's way is not. We have a choice. We can keep pressing and guessing, or we can read the instructions.